Hi, I'm David, and welcome to the DataSaurus Rex podcast, where we interview data visualization experts and get to know them and their data visits a little bit better. By the end, you should learn new skills and get inspired to enhance your own data viz game. Today's guest is Mike Cisneros, who's made an amazing viz about baseball, but he's also a Tableau Zen master and an amazing contributor to the Tableau community. So, yeah, welcome, Mike. Thanks for coming onto the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, David. It's a pleasure.
Cool. Before we go on, is there anything else I missed you want to like maybe mention about yourself before we kick on, or have I kind of covered?
No, I feel like we'll end up finding out a lot about both of us as the time goes on.
I like that. Okay, no, that's great. Okay, cool. So for those of you who are new to the podcast, what we're going to do is for the first half, we're going to explore an amazing viz made by Mike. I'm going to explore it in the browser. So for those on the audio podcast, the link to the video podcast is in the show notes below, but also Mike's actual viz, so you can go and explore and enjoy it too. And I'm just going to throw a couple of questions at him. Then in the second half, I'm going to fire some rapid fire questions so we get to know a little bit more about Mike. So that's kind of how it goes. And let's just dive into the first question. And I bring up the viz. So Mike, this is a really awesome viz about baseball. I have full disclosure, I'm not really down with baseball. I did go to one game live, and it made sense the more drunk I got. But then when I woke up the next day, I forgot how it all works. So apologies if I ask any sort of dumb sport questions. But speaking of good questions, what was the inspiration for this viz?
Well, I am actually a relatively big baseball fan. It's not a sport that I played much as an adult, but I played it when I was younger, and I've always liked the strategy of it and the pace of it. And to me, it rewards watching over the course of an entire season rather than just the course of a game. I think that there are strategies that play themselves out over time, and it's just a different kind of slower paced sort of cerebral game. And I've always enjoyed that. Although obviously you need to be physically talented to succeed at it as well. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I was inspired to make this viz is because I am a big fan, and I always have been a big fan, of Jacob Olszewka's visualizations. And he was on stage for Iron Viz in 2017. He had a fantastic year in 2017. What I remember is that he entered all three feeders and had just fantastic vizzes in all three of them. I met him at, I want to say, a Tapestry conference, and found out that he has a baseball background himself. I think he played a little bit when he was younger at a much higher level than I would ever aspire to play at. Mm-hmm. And he has since created a number of outstanding baseball visualizations himself.
Wow.
And so when I saw that he was going to be participating as one of the co-hosts of the Sports Viz Sunday project for the month of March, I felt like it was a good opportunity for me to get involved in doing sports visualizations, because I've been relatively outspoken in the past about how I think that there are a lot of sports visualizations. I tend not to do them because I think that you have to be really, really good at visualizing them to get your work seen in the crowd. Yep. Like I feel like it's kind of easy to do because there's so much data, like as baseball especially, there's so much quantitative data that's out there already. And there are so many people who get so into the quantitative side of baseball. I've always been a little bit wary of it, but to honor Jacob, I suppose, I felt like this was a good time for me to get involved. But in addition to the baseball side of it, there was also the element that I wanted to bring, which was a sort of a socially aware side of it. Now, I talked before, I want to say maybe at the, as a Tableau Fringe presentation once, where I was talking about how you can't always like beat people over the head with whatever message you're trying to give them in your viz. Sometimes you have to sneak messages in through the back door or through a side window or what have you. Because people aren't necessarily responsive to like that kind of direct messaging. And so I was aware that in baseball, there's a sort of a labor relations issue where there's a definite imbalance among major league and minor league players who are also professional players, where it's very difficult to actually get compensated at the level of performance that you provide, which I suppose sometimes can sound like millionaires crying about not being multimillionaires. But in the major league and minor league system, only about 80%, well, about only about 20% of players, I'm sorry, ever make it to the major leagues out of the minor league system.
Oh, wow.
So these are professional players. Like their aspiration is to become major league players, right? But in the minor leagues, even at the highest level of minor leagues, right below the majors, people make about $10,000 a month on average. And they work 5 months. So at the lower levels, it averages about $6,000 a month. But most of the players at the rookie league and A-league level will make about $1,000 a month. And they don't get paid for when they work. So players are expected to play in the minor leagues for several years before they make it to the major leagues. Now, when players make it to the major leagues, those 20% of people who make it to the major leagues, they are bound to the team that owns their contract for another 6 years. And their salaries are pegged for the first 3 years to very specific amounts.
Oh, wow.
So a first-year player in the major leagues this year makes about $500,000 a year. That's fine. For years 4, 5, and 6, they have to go before a binding arbitration panel where the club will actually argue why they shouldn't be paid as much as they feel they earned. And the player has to argue why they should be paid as much as they earn, as they want to earn. And whatever the arbitrator decides is what they decide. So you have to make it to their seventh year of being in the major leagues. And that's, you know, on a day's served. So like 6 full years of every day of being in the major leagues before you finally are able to negotiate a salary for yourself that isn't predetermined.
Wow.
And that is about 1.7% of all professional baseball players ever make it to the free agency level.
Right. I wasn't aware of that at all. That's suboptimal for the players.
It is suboptimal. So even in this system, which is very top heavy, of course, it was still thought that, well, you want to have the promise at least of getting paid in free agency. If you were to make it there, if you're one of those top echelon players, you want to get paid in free agency. And what we've been seeing lately is that teams are getting smarter, in quotation marks, about what players are valuable to have on the team and what players aren't valuable to have. What they're discovering is that players reach their peak performance at about age 27, 28, which coincidentally is usually within those 6 years that the club still owns the rights to them and they don't have to pay them fair market value.
Right.
What you have is a situation where when the players are in their peak earning years, they're not getting paid commensurate with their ability. And then when they finally can get paid, teams are saying, but we'd rather have younger, cheaper talent. That's more in their jargon, controllable talent.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrible.
So this is a lot of labor talk. And so it's a socioeconomic viz that I tried to do undercover of a sports viz. Because what I was trying to do was blend the on-field the predicted on-field performance of players with their salaries and also with their ages, but all three of those things together. So you could, as a sports fan, you could look at it and see, how is my team getting a bargain on players? Which players are projected to perform really well, but they don't get paid that much. So that's good for my team, right? We're getting a bargain. We can spend more money in other places. But, you know, baseball doesn't actually have a salary cap. They can spend as much money on players as they want to. There's a luxury tax, but there's no salary cap. So I wanted to portray the viz so that the sports fan who's used to thinking of that in terms of good value and the statistic that they use is WAR, which is WAR, wins above replacement.
That's what it means. Okay.
Like this one player might have a WAR of 3, which means that if you picked any random player you could sign for the league minimum salary, this other player who's a 3 WAR player would end up contributing enough to the team that they would probably win about 3 more games with that player than the first player.
Got you.
It's a very complex combination of a lot of other statistics, but it's a general predictive index for player performance.
So, right. So the higher, the better. Is that how
right,
I should
the
read
higher,
it?
Yeah. The better.
Okay. Cool.
So we were in spring training. Baseball season was going to come up in April. So I decided to, instead of use actual WAR statistics from past years and actual salary statistics, I thought everybody wants to know how their team's going to do this coming year. Let's do some prediction, use the predicted WAR that you know the statistics gurus at various baseball fan sites have put together. And use the salaries for the upcoming year and do a let's look ahead viz.
Oh, I see. That's smart.
Much to my chagrin, that is what I decided to do.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, so that's an amazing inspiration. So because you were just we were chatting just before the show started. You also mentioned the title of your viz is kind of related to that too, because it's like looking at the pay about the more younger talented people who may not be put on at certain times.
Right, traditionally when your team is not doing very well over the course of the season, there's a clamor amongst the fan base late on to say, play the kids, give the young players a chance to play so we can see if they're any good, so we can see if they should be given a chance as a starter next season or if we need to look for outside help next year. So that's why I went with play, but don't pay the kids, because the kids are playing, but because they are valuable in terms of wins above replacement, but don't pay them because they're in a system where you don't have to pay them very much.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because, yeah, just looking at the viz, it's really awesome. Because, yeah, you can kind of see there's that slight peak at the top of the first chart of the viz where they had got that golden age of like 27, 20, 28. And it seems to that's when they reach their peak and then it goes down.
Right.
But then that kind of, for me at least, as an outsider, I'm inferring that that means they got less bargaining power later on to be like, hey, pay me a lot now. Because they're like, well, no, you're just going to get worse. So we're just higher. Which seems it's all stacked against them, which isn't great. Yeah.
That's true. And there are some, as you scroll down in the viz, I tried to pick out some individual stories that would help to anchor somebody who's going through the viz to see, well, what does this mean? The very top, I'll be honest, it's very hard to take much away from the top part of the viz because it's everybody overlaid on everybody. So you can't really pick out anybody, but it's visually arresting. So I knew that we'd put individual stories together in the viz as you move down the page so that you could see what it was that you were meant to get out of the data in certain ways. And one of those stories did happen to be the fact that there are people who had been given these large contracts when they were in their age 30, age 31 seasons, and they are some of the most onerous contracts now because the players have declined. They're some of the highest paid players in the league, but they are also some of the worst performing, and I think that also has. That's something that owners of teams can point to and say, well, this is why we don't give high dollar value long contracts anymore.
Right. I see. But that's great. I love the way you've kind of tied it to a narrative. So yeah, you're right. It's like the top one draws you in, but then then you tell that story, which I love because it's, I think one individual image or visualization can't be everything for everyone. So it's great that you've had this considered approach to attract people's attention, then draw them in, and then help them sort of, right at the bottom from what I can see, then you empower people to go, hey, go check out your team. And I love that. You get to encourage them to explore the data, what they care about.
And that's what I expect every fan was going to ultimately want. They're going to want to know, well, what about my team? And it's actually a lot clearer, at least from my perspective, once you see it as a single team. And I also did a little small multiple there, so that you could see at a glance just sort of what each individual team's overall picture looks like in comparison with the other teams. And it's not especially labeled there, but for a baseball fan, they would know that they're organized in terms of what division they're in and what league they're in, and sort of also how they're expected to perform overall.
Yeah, no, I'm even as a self-confessed baseball newbie, I'm actually starting to get some good insights here, looking at like the New York Yankees, or is it still the Red Sox for Boston? Like,
yeah,
I can see, yeah, like Boston's got some amazing war people, like pre and post that like contracting age, which is kind of cool to see. And yeah.
And so what you're doing by mentioning that is starting to point out the difficulties of visualizing something that's a prediction, because this was something that I created in March during spring training. And now here we are 3 weeks into the actual baseball season, and the Red Sox are, I think, the second worst performing team in all of baseball.
Oh, no.
It's sort of that is like one of the biggest stories so far of the baseball season, is why are the world champion, defending champion Boston Red Sox doing so poorly? Why are they underperforming when all of the numbers say they should be performing at such a high level? And the answer is you don't know, because it takes like 2/5 of the season before you have any idea of whether things are just luck or whether they're skill, because baseball is such a high variance sport.
Yeah, no, totally. And but I think it's great to see, because someone like me, yeah, who doesn't know the subject matter well, the fact that your viz can actually now make this come to life for people even with that low knowledge is a sign of how great that viz is. So I can only imagine, if, you know, I know all these players and stuff, like, and a lot more of the terminology, I'd get even more out of it. So I think, yeah, you made it really accessible in a good way. Which I really appreciate. And I think that's a sign of a good viz.
I need to hit the sweet spot between somebody who is interested in baseball but doesn't know that much about it and then gets more out of it, and not the person who knows a ton of baseball and then wants to quibble over, well, why did you only put this number of people and why do you have this person listed as the number 4 starting pitcher when they're actually the number 5 starting pitcher? I'm like, well,
yeah,
calm down. Like,
there's
one moment in time. I'm doing the best I can over here.
Yeah, yeah, there's a balance. And like, again, yeah, like there's getting it done, and then there's perfection too. And I guess I'd rather get it out than, I just remember like having a lot of discussions with this Game of Thrones fizz I did, where I think I mislabeled some peasants who got killed.
Oh,
and then like, I know, right? And then it sparked this huge debate on one of the subreddits of like, actually, these are Lannister peasants and not the, and I'm like, okay, cool, I will fix that, but I'm sorry, like, don't get too angry with me. I'm it's like, yeah, but you're right, there's that balance, like, yeah, like how in depth do you go to appease the hardcore fans, and then but how do you make it accessible too? Yeah, okay, I like that. Okay, okay, cool. So let's move on to the next question. But I feel I think we've actually naturally organically answered a few of the upcoming ones, but that's great. That's how a conversation and a podcast should go. So if we encounter those, I'll just kind of skip past. But but I guess you mentioned you kind of did some prediction data. So the next question is, how do you go about collecting the data? So is this something you made, or did you find and then work some magic on top? Or yeah, how did you go about collecting the data which drives this viz?
So part of the prediction data, I didn't have to do anything with, because there's a home. There are many sites out on the web for baseball fanatics, and I leveraged their data to build some of the stuff. Fangraphs is the one that I used to get the predicted WAR for different players. They already had it for not just the people who ended up in this viz, but for people who are well down into the minor leagues and who may appear at some point this season, who may appear at some point in some subsequent season. There's about, let's see, there's 25 active roster, active players on active rosters. There's 30 teams. So there's about 750 major league players at any one given time. But Fangraphs had, I think, something like 2,000 people that they had WAR predictions for, because people are going to cycle in and out over the course of the season. You never, you never start and finish with the same people. People get hurt, people underperform, you know, people hurt their hand moving a statue in the bathroom. People cut their hand on drones. Because, you know, actual baseball injuries, by the way.
I see, yeah, like life, unpredictable stuff gets in the way. Okay, right. So I quite a big data set.
Yeah, I used Fangraphs for the WAR.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, like, it was just finding out people's, who was going to be on the team and what positions they were going to play, turned out to be one of the more difficult challenges, Because we were in spring training, and in spring training, you have tons of people working out, trying to make the team, but you don't know yet who's going to make the team. And you don't know yet of the people who make the team, which ones are going to be the starters. Are these people going to be starting pitchers, or maybe they're going to start off being relief pitchers? They're not going to be part of the big five starting pitchers. There was a time when I was trying to identify more at a more granular level what position people were going to play, because for pitchers who aren't starters, they tend to have sort of defined roles in baseball, but it just got so complicated trying to figure out like different teams use different ones in different ways. And I had to stop somewhere.
I see. So you just kind of,
and I also had to decide, do I want to consider only the 25 people who are going to make the roster on opening day? Or do I want to consider everybody? There's a larger roster that's 40 people. It's like, these are the people we think might contribute at some point this year. Should I use those?
I see.
All of these different data sources spell people's names differently, of course. Some use diacriticals, some don't. Players, and by the way, and the salary data I had to get from yet another place because that's not always in the same place. So, and by the way, while this is going on, this is all like manually scraped too. And by scraped, I mean I go to the websites and I scraped it and I pasted it, because there was good way. It was in terrible formats in most places. Fangraphs was good, but everything else was in terrible formats.
Ouch.
And while all this was going on, people were signing new contracts. People were getting cut from teams or getting picked up on different teams.
Oh no!
I redid the whole set of players once. Like, I had it all put together once. I was building the viz. Then I realized this is already out of date. Like, I'm 10 days down the road and it's all out of date. So I redid it all close to when I was ready to publish it, so it would be as up to date as I could possibly get it.
Right.
I knew it was going to be out of date just about as soon as I posted it, because then games start. And once games start, players are going to start performing for real. And then their projected war, like they may, like you start to find out pretty soon that they're just not going to perform the way that you predicted they were going to perform.
Yeah, so, for better or worse. Yeah. Okay.
Many contracts have been signed since then too. It seems that the trend now is to sign players to extensions. So like they'll end up staying with their team instead of trying to go into free agency. But that's because they're afraid of the declining market for free agents. So they're staying with their original team and giving up some of their free agent years for the security of having a contract.
Interesting. But that's great to hear, and that's amazing dedication. Like, I think often people forget that behind any great viz is a great data source. So it's really inspiring to hear that, you've found these sources, and even at points you manually poured it out. And I can see why you wanted to limit the scope, because even 700 versus 2000, that's a lot of copy, control C, control V.
Right.
It's great to see, but like you didn't see that as a barrier. You're like, right, I still want to make this come to life. Let's do this. Obviously, you're not going to update it every day, but it's just awesome that you've done that. And it just goes to show, like, often if you want to make a good viz, the data might not be out there. So go and make your own data set. Go do it. Like, again, I'm not. Like, I did the same with, I did a viz where I tasted 190 combinations of food. That database doesn't exist. You just got to make it. Or I wrote down every death of Game of Thrones, and because I thought there's going to be a good story in that. So I love that you've done this too, and you didn't let that put you off. And
I very
the results.
Much like, I really like creating your own data set from your own experience or from something out in the world. I've mentioned to you before, I really liked the tastes of this that you did, specifically, not just because you went through the effort of doing it, you put yourself through the horror of doing it, but also because you captured the experience of doing it on video as well as creating the viz for it. And I thought that was great. And I would like to see more. And, when you do create your own viz, or when you do create your own data set, like, there's a huge advantage is you know everything about it. You know where it came from. You know how it was collected. You know what you can and can't say about it. You know what was excluded from it. Like you know everything you can possibly know about your data. And that's a really strong position to start from.
Yeah.
And you also know there's probably nobody else making a similar viz from the data that you're collecting because you collected it. Who else has it? Just you.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's kind of unique and fun. And yeah, you know, intimately, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, hot tip for anyone listening, do not eat salt and Coca-Cola. That tastes terrible. And paprika and coffee, also not a great idea. But I've done that, so you don't have to. And it's, yeah, but it was fun to do. I was like, yeah, I think you're right. Like, I put myself through it. I could see all the 190 like samples lined up. And I was like, some of them I'm looking forward to. Others, I am not. And but you gotta like with you copying, pasting all those things, you got to stay committed, right? Committed to the goal. So yeah.
Absolutely. So
thanks. Yeah. We know the pain. Yeah. It's good.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. No, thanks so much for that. Okay. So let's jump onto the next question. But actually I think we've kind of touched upon it, about like the storytelling element, but, the question is, how did you approach the creation of this viz? So maybe not on the structure because we've covered that, but how did you go about, I guess you've got like the baseball pitch and all the shapes and the sort of the different roles overlaid. I'd love to understand, and for our listeners too, like how you went about making that, because that's also a curved, like kind of bar chart,
right?
Kind of
right.
thing.
Well, right, like you say, I always wanted to have I had that field metaphor in mind already from the very beginning. I just didn't know how I was gonna go on from there. Like I knew I wanted to place the starting players in the positions on the field where they belonged. And then I knew I wanted to place the pitchers somewhere. So I sort of figured out, well, I'll line them up along the baselines, I guess. And then what am I going to do with all the extra players? I don't want to jam them into a corner because that looks weird. And so I just, I started with the idea that everything is, you can always plot everything on X, Y. So I actually had the field, if you can see what it looks like in the viz, imagine it rotated about 45 degrees in either direction. And when you rotate it 45 degrees, then it's basically a pretty simple scatter plot like chart. And you can sort of see there's the X, Y's were easy to use graph paper to figure out, well, this is about where I should put everybody. So as I was originally building it, I was building it in that tilted way of about 45 degrees.
Oh, I see. Yep.
So then when you get to the part where all of the players are at an angle, I think a number of people have figured out the formula for plotting things at an angle or on a circle anyway.
I see. Is it a bit of trigonometry and you whack it into like a calculator field? Is that roughly?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And then cool. The bars, like forget for a second that there are bars there at all. Just imagine that there's a starting point and an ending point.
Right. Yep.
And so those are just sort of spiking out a little bit more. It's just one, it's another circle with a slightly larger radius and then yet another circle where the radius is variable depending on that one war variable.
Oh, crikey. Okay. Okay. I think that makes sense.
So if you forget about all of the starters for a second, and then you just see, well, there's all the fringe players, they're on one radius.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the baseline of every player, that's on another radius.
Right.
And then the top of every one of those bars is all on, that's all on its own radius, but that's data driven.
I see. Crikey. I haven't, I'll be honest, I haven't really explored too much with the kind of radio stuff, but it does look amazing. And
I got to credit Chris DiMartini because he was the first one who used this technique he's the first one I knew used it of scaffolding data this way, where he realized like you didn't have to using a dual axis, you can only use the same data twice, you know, on the same worksheet. But if you scaffold your data like multiple times on the back end, which is what I did, like there's like every piece of data like with, and then I called it like series A, and then there's that same data on series B and the same data series C. Like if you do that, as long as you're still using like circles for all of them,
mm-hmm.
then you can have as many as you want. So really, what I have there is a dual axis chart where one of those axes has three sets of circles and the other axes has one set of lines that connects the points from the other two series.
That's genius. Wow. That's
so it's not actually it, like you would think that that has to be worksheets overlaid on top of worksheets overlaid on top of worksheets. Yeah, but it really isn't. It's actually just one worksheet, but it's a lot of different data sets all thrown together.
Crikey.
So when you get to like the bottom one, you can see that there are glows underneath some of the players' feet.
Ah, yes. Yeah. How did you approach
that? I didn't do
that
at the top because it's too busy at the top.
Yeah.
At the bottom, like the glows are one series. The individual players are another series. The team label is a third series. And then the bars are the fourth and fifth series.
That's amazing. And that's so creative. But again, leads to such a powerful viz.
And it's really... Wow. And it's the... Like you said, it's just the trigonometry of like you start by plotting points. And then you figure out, well, from there, I have to figure out the circle part. And from there, I have to figure out the bar part of the circle part. And from there, I have to rotate it 45 degrees. And then if you just take it in turn, honestly, it looks a mess. Like, because I don't comment things very well when I'm coding.
Right.
But it's not terrible. No. Because it got so complicated and I was doing it over time. Like, I think I'm going to have to remind myself of what I'm doing here.
Or
I'm going to totally lose it. So.
But I love that. Like and also the phrase you mentioned earlier, like scaffolding the data. You know, you don't necessarily have to rely on a tool to do that. You can actually embed it into the data. That's really smart. And I've just noticed, and this is what I love about Tableau Public, right at the bottom, if anyone's, you've followed along and you want to work out how to do it, it looks like we can download the workbook. Is that correct? And and people can then, you can explore how Mike's done this and like backwards engineer it and stuff like that. So I think one of the beauties of Tableau Public and the community is people like Mike make these great vizzes, but then, and you're like, wow, that's amazing. And often people are like, oh, well, there's no way I'm going to make that. But they're often, and like here, the creators do share their work. So you can, if you want to, figure out how it's done. So actually, I'm going to download that right now and have a play around afterwards.
I can't see, unless you're using something where like your client is forbidding you to share the data, I don't see any reason to prevent your workbooks from being downloaded. I didn't invent any of this stuff. Like, I shouldn't be trying to prevent other people from using these same techniques to create new stuff of their own. It's just remixing stuff other people have already done.
Yeah. No, that's very fair. And actually, I do have to confess, there's one workbook I have not made shareable just for now. It's actually my Game of Thrones one, where I, because I spent a lot of time recording every death. So I see that as a time investment. But it's funny you mention that, because I think at the end of the season, the finale, I'm actually going to release that data source and see what other people can do with it. So it's kind of like my little baby and I'm going to like let it fly. But you're right, on the whole, like, yeah, I totally agree. People should totally share that stuff, because it's,
Have you still been tracking? Are you still tracking the death?
I'm about to get back into it. So spoiler alert, if anyone is catching up on Game of Thrones, but I stopped at the end of season 6 because there's that huge event where I think literally hundreds of people die in like about 5 seconds. And it kind of broke me. So I want to get back into it. And also, I don't want to get on a tangent, but like the attribution, because one of my dimensions is who killed the person, but you never see who... who actually pulled the trigger, quote marks. So it kind of raises this conundrum, like, we know who ordered the killings, but we don't know who actually did it. So I've got to go figure that one out. But so to answer your question, I will get back into it. I'm going to ramp back up because I have been broken by that one scene, but I can't let that stop me, I guess. So
I think that hill is just getting steeper and steeper.
It's not gonna ease up, especially coming into this. I predict there's gonna be a lot more fatalities in this last season. So we'll see. I'll keep trying as best I can. Cool. No, thanks, man. So the next question is actually, what are the best insights you've got? But I feel we've already covered that. So I guess that we won't dwell on that. It's more about that disparate or the unfairness of like they restrict them in their prime, and then it's like it's a kind of crapshoot if they do become a free agent later on, when you could argue. So I think this is great. You've already covered it. So I think maybe we'll skip past that one. Unless there are any other like amazing insights, like one team was terrible at this or some, one team was amazing. Like, up to you.
I can tell you like that there is one team, like the Baltimore Orioles, like have such an absurdly low payroll right now. Mm-hmm. And their players have an absurdly low WAR. So that indicates a team that's not trying to win.
Is that the BAL? Because I've zoomed into them now on the Viz, so people can BAL. See it. But yeah, that's so low. Yeah, wow.
And another insight that I enjoy is Mike Trout, who's the consensus best player in baseball, mm-hmm. Plays for Anaheim.
Is he that super? Oh, there he is. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Look at that.
But
super high bar.
He also happens to be good value. Like he's the highest paid player, but he's so good that he's technically still undervalued because stats guys have come up with what the approximate cost of one WAR is. So on average, Mike Trout's worth about 50% more WAR than what he is paid.
Oh, wow.
Even at the highest paid player in baseball.
Yeah, crikey.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, he's paid nearly $37 million, but he's still a steal because his WAR per million is like amazing. That's so cool. Again, that's awesome. Again, as soon as you called that out and I could see that, I'm like, oh, yep, what's that outlier? And yeah, that's really fascinating. So that's a great insight. Like, I guess it works both ways. He can now turn back and go, well, I'm actually still a bargain, guys. Like, keep paying me this ridiculous amount of money.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wish I could say that. That's a salary he just signed because he wants to stay in Anaheim with the Angels for his entire career.
Oh, amazing. Well, that's great. So, that's win-win for everyone. Yeah. I like it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing that it was interesting for me to find is just how many players are on those low and arbitration-determined salaries that I didn't know that it was only... that it was like 80%+ of players are still on those low salaries. Like I would have assumed more were free agents, but they are not.
Wow. That's again, you brought it to life. Now at least people can kind of talk about it. And yeah, that's awesome. Okay, great. So the next question, again, I feel we've already answered this. So like what skills did you learn? We've already covered like the radial, like trigonometry stuff. So I feel we can kind of skip past that. But again, it's great. I love this. Just an organic chat. Which is cool. So let's move on to the next one. So this is obviously great. And I'm just going to skip to your Tableau public page to show people also what else you do. But what project is next? What's in your pipeline?
Well, as far as Vizzes go, like I was messing around a little bit with Formula One, believe it or not.
Okay.
And trying to see what I can do showing like how a race goes in time, which is harder in Tableau than it should be because of the that it mostly you want to like skip ahead through time and it's hard to do that automatically. Mm-hmm. But I was giving that a shot. I'd seen a Netflix doc on Formula One right before the season this year, and I got really into it because of the doc. So I started watching races, which so far here they've been at like 2 a.m. So that's a challenge, but they don't last very long either. So
they're pretty quickly. But that's awesome. So Formula One Viz, that sounds exciting. I don't know if you've seen many of those.
It's really off brand for me, but that happens to be what caught my attention. So that's more of a technical and fun challenge. And what I've been working on actually a lot is something that Layla Mannheim and I have been talking about a lot, which was we're trying to think about a different approach to design. You know, the word design means a lot of things to a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. And she certainly has a reputation in the community as being a good designer. And I think that I have sort of a reputation of being a good designer in the community. But when people say, oh, Layla's a good designer or you're a good designer, I'm not sure what they specifically mean. And I'm not sure that what they mean is the same thing that I mean when I'm thinking about design. So we want to talk about, or we've been thinking a lot about, and we've been actually writing a bit about a different way of thinking about the products that we create and not thinking about designing them, but rather creating information experiences, I guess is what we've decided to delineate them as.
Oh.
Because we want to emphasize that when we're creating stuff, we are not really thinking of the product as the end design. The product is the information.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The information is the end goal. Like, and the relationship that your audience or your customer or your consumer has with the information. And we've been thinking a lot about like how you measure it and what your actual goals are and what it means to be that creator, but also ultimately be removed from the process because the stuff that you create doesn't end up being stuff that you stand next to and explain and show and shepherd because you create things and then you let them go and you have to be happy with how they're perceived. So it's more about taking on a different approach to design in quotation marks and changing that notion of what design is in our community.
So is that going to be released in the near future? I'm just trying to think how I can link or share that with our audience. So if they follow you, they'll be able to see that as that comes out.
I'm sure we'll be talking about it more publicly in the coming months. We've been writing about it as well, and we'll start publishing some of the things that we've been writing in the weeks to come.
Amazing. Cool. Exciting. So yeah, just scrolling through your library, there was a ton of other cool visits there. So I feel we're like down the line, we're going to have to get you back and talk about some of those. So, cause they all look amazing. They're all like so creative. So I guess they look quite technically like very capable, and I'm just excited to find the stories within them too. Cause again, it seems you embed that. So yeah, I'm going to go have a play, but hopefully we can, chat about some of those another time. So excellent. Okay, cool. So I think, before we move on to rapid fire questions, is there anything else you'd like to promote? We've covered quite a bit, but,
Yeah, I very much want to promote the idea that everybody should pick up a copy of Ruined by Design, Ooh. Which is the new book by Mike Montero. And it is about what designers have done to the world by abdicating their responsibility to be gatekeepers and by making decisions without consideration for ethical concerns or without consideration for any of the other things that we should have been thinking about along the way. It's a passionate and profane book. And it gets me fired up, basically at least once on every page. And I think anybody who is a creator, either professionally or personally, would do well to read it and think about how it applies to the things that we have done and the things that we should be doing, going forward.
Okay, cool. I'm just bringing it up on the screen. Is it, so essentially, by Mike Montero. Yeah. So, okay, great. I'm going to buy that straight after this. That's amazing. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. I've got it up on screen. Oh, yeah. I'll put a link below too. If you recommend it, I'm totally on board. I'm going to buy that. Cool. Okay. No, thanks for that. All thanks right. for sharing that.
Great.
Right. Okay. So we've finished that round. So we're going to get into the rapid fire questions and,
all right.
Yeah. Let's, we're going to stick to, I guess, we'll try and keep them quick. But yeah, this is great. So let's do it. Are you ready?
Is it timed? Do I have a clock I have to beat?
It's not. Maybe I should, maybe that's a bit mean. I'll just have a little mental clock. But dive in.
However long it takes.
Yeah, yeah.
Put that clock up. Start it at 1:52, yeah. and I just have to beat the buzzer.
And it just blares a klaxon at the end. It's like, I like it. Okay, next version. okay. So first question is, pie charts, love them or loathe them?
I am fine with pie charts as long as it's part to whole. I loathe them otherwise. And I especially loathe racetrack charts. And I loathe donut charts because they are pie charts who are lying to themselves.
Yeah, I like them. That's great. I love it. There's a time and a place for them. But yeah, you're right. Often they don't serve the data they're showing. So I like that. That's a good quote about donut charts. I'm going to take that. Okay, next one. Who or what publications about DataViz do you follow regularly? Or the top ones?
Because I am an old, I still get newsletters. I get the Data is Plural newsletter, which is Jeremy Singer Vines. I get Numlock News, by Walt Hickey. I really like that one. That's a great daily newsletter. I subscribe to a newsletter by a journalist, Rachel Shalom, and it's called Best in Digital Storytelling. It's the best visualization she's been looking at recently, and it's also visualization journalism posts. Job openings as well.
Oh, cool.
I've always liked the Data Beats. I don't know if they're on ice now or if they are just working on things under a cloak of secrecy, but Rob and Chris, I hope you get more stuff out in the future.
Cool.
You know, Feedly to keep up with all the blogs, the Medium Daily Digest, but basically it's Twitter feed for all the Tableau stuff and then all the other media to keep up with other data journalism, other art, other everything else that informs the things that we create.
Amazing. Okay, no, thank you. I'm going to subscribe to this. I hadn't heard about some of those, but again, they sound really interesting. So when I find them, I'll put them at the link or in the show notes description below so everyone else can find them and enjoy that. Okay, great. What is your number one Tableau trick for people new to Tableau?
So I only discovered this recently, and I want to credit the person who pointed it out to me, but it's I often get asked to make mockups of dashboards, and I don't have data to use with them. Mm-hmm. And I used to just go to Mockaroo and generate fake data from that, because you can generate stuff from that. Mm-hmm. But what I found out is that you can just use Superstore and World Indicators and re-alias all the fields and make them literally whatever you want.
Oh,
so
wow.
So you can just use, because it's numeric data and it's categorical data and it's all preset for you. And if you need it to look a little different, write a few calculations. But yeah, that saved me a ton of time of trying to fake up data. I already have fake data. I just have to change the aliases.
That's really smart. I didn't actually think about that. Yeah, because for those of you who don't know, with Tableau, any version, there's built-in data sets called Superstore or World Indicators. And they focus on business or world, like, I guess, population or metric data. But yeah, what's to stop you from renaming them? A number's a number, right? You can just change the labels. And that's really smart. I like that. That's because then it's built in, it's accessible. Everyone has that. Yeah. You don't have to go waste time getting data. So that's really smart.
Right.
That's fun. Thank you. Okay. What is your favorite chart type?
So my favorite chart type is DataViz in real life, which is... I first thought of it that way because a friend of mine, like every year, he and his kid dump out their Halloween candy haul and they organize them by what candy they got and they build like real life, you know, piles. So it looks like a real life data viz. And there was a time that at the office, we organized all of the sauce packets we'd gotten from Taco Bell over the course of, I don't know how many months. And organized it into a data viz using real life things. I just like it when stuff in the world reveals like actual data. Like when there's those push button locks where some of it is worn off because they haven't changed the number of the lock in forever.
so you
look at it and you're like, well, I'm pretty sure your code's 125 because that's what's worn off.
Yeah, that's smart. It's
That's my favorite chart type, real life data viz.
Oh, I like that. Hang on, just 2 seconds. I was going to show you something.
Yep.
So essentially, after Halloween in Singapore, there was a ton of candy, which was like half price. And I've tried attempting this twice. A real life data viz, like looking at Skittles and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I keep on failing because I either one, eat the data, or I just feel like this. I can't find a way to like visualize it in the real world. But I need to get better at it. But that's why I've got like 2,000 Skittles in my fridge right now because I need to find a way to actually make this look good and interesting. So, but it's interesting you mentioned real life visits. Yeah. So, yeah, I think certain visits you got to have the patience to not eat your data because, I ate like 4 bags of Haribo.
Skittles.
Yeah,
I just saw something about Skittles within the last week of somebody was doing this data experiment of how many bags of Skittles do you have to open before you get the same distribution
interesting.
In any two bags. And I feel like it was something like 428 bags they opened before they got an identical color distribution.
Oh, that's so cool. Okay, I'll have to try and find that. There are like-minded people out there. I like that.
Right.
But that's cool. I hadn't thought about the real-life business. It's I've seen one recently with teacups. It's like, it's a dual axis, but the same axis on both. And it's like milk versus like how milky your coffee is. Yep. So top left is white, bottom right is black, and you see all the different grades.
Right.
So it's, I like those because they're kind of fun. They're accessible. People can relate to them because it's real world stuff. So that's a great point. I like that. I haven't heard that one before about chart types. So thank you. Other than Tableau, what tools have you been using?
Well, recently I tried Flourished Studio for the first time, and it's kind of basic as far as what data you can put into it, but it's got a lot of different types of charts already pre-baked into it. So I think it's got a lot of promise. I'm jealous of people who have Alteryx because everybody who uses Alteryx says Alteryx is amazing. I can't ever get a business use case for it. Prep's actually pretty good for what I've needed. I want to be part of the cool kids. I want to know Alteryx.
I keep hearing it and I'm like, I want in too, but it's a lot to pay for a hobbyist.
Speaking of a lot to pay for a hobbyist, I also want to mess with the Apple Pencil because I want to do more sketching that I can then bring into things, except that it would require me to also mess with a brand new iPad Pro. And there's a certain level of cost that I don't want to go beyond just to like, I wonder if this would be fun. Mm. I wonder if I could do this. Like, you know what else works? Pencils, graph paper.
True. I did experiment. I asked for one for my, I guess, my birthday, Christmas combined. And it's actually really good. If you do, we can talk offline, but they are pretty handy. And some of the software is very intuitive. Like I use Notability and it's so great. You can write stuff out, draw straight lines, and you don't have to like fight the UI. And like, whereas often other terrible applications you do. And the sensitivity is amazing. So that's helped me draw out a lot of visits. So if you're on the fence, I would definitely, it's worth exploring.
You expand that direction.
Yeah, and I've found some good apps which I could help.
Have you used graphics tablets before, like a Wacom tablet or something?
I did a while back, yeah. But I felt not having the feedback loop of what you see on the tablet, unless you spend like thousands on a high-end Wacom, not having that feedback of where you put the pen is what you see. It's kind of disjointed when it's on the screen. So that's why I liked having the iPad a bit better because it's, you see what you're drawing, if that makes sense.
That was going to be my middle of the road solution. Mm-hmm. But then I had the same concerns as what you just described is I feel like I'd constantly be in the wrong place and then might as well just draw and then scan it and buy a scanner for $40.
No, that makes sense. That's cool. It's interesting software. Again, I haven't heard that one before, from the other guests. So that's But again, it's good because I felt like I was using a lot of paper. So, and also just I got terrible handwriting and make mistakes. So if I can just delete stuff and redo it, so it looks perfect straight away, then it's all good. But no, highly recommend an iPad.
When people do sketch notes, I look at it, I'm like, how in the world did you do that? How did you know where this talk was going to go? How did you know to place things here? I'm like, it's because they're moving things around and stretching them and
resize it. It's so true. Like, whereas if you do it paper, you're like, God, no, it really should have been over here, or I should have color coded that. And there's plenty of ways to do that in a quick, intuitive way using an iPad Pro. So again, not sponsored, but again, recommend if you can get one. It's the investment. You won't get buyer's remorse. Well, that's what I felt. Yeah.
Cool. There's no affiliate link or anything?
No, I should put one in. I was plugging Made the Makeover Monday book last episode. So I really should make one, but I just genuinely like them. So I'm like, hey, get this. It's cool. I like it. Uh-huh. But I should be more Machiavellian with that stuff. Okay. So next question, what was your first version of Tableau?
So I know I dabbled in it because the customer that we had at the time had a copy of it when it was version 6 or 7, but I didn't really use it. Mm-hmm. When we implemented it at my office, it was in 2014. And so I think that it was 8.2 is the first version I used.
Okay, cool. That's still good.
It was right before level of detail calculations, maybe.
That was a big one. But I think the earlier you use it, the more you appreciate it. All the stuff Tableau does. Like, I think I got in like the late 6, And there was so much stuff, like, just wasn't there. But it was still great, light years ahead. So just seeing it evolve is so good. So I think, yeah, if you got into it at 8, you're probably, like, equally as excited as I am to see all these cool new features come out constantly, which is good. Yeah. Okay, exciting. Definitely. Oh, you're old school. I like it. me too. I'm even older. Yeah. Okay, so speaking of Tableau and features, what would be the number one feature you'd love Tableau to implement, which they haven't already?
Okay, so the question I heard is, what three features do you want Tableau to implement? So in ascending order, I'm giving you number 10 is I want responsive bootstrap style layout containers because I don't like having to design for just one canvas size and for mobile to be one other canvas size. Why can't I make it 50% or three and asterisk or whatever? And why can't I have different versions for different sizes? So that's 10. Okay. Number 9 would be embedded fonts because I get bored of the same fonts all over. Like I'm in a Georgia state of mind lately because that's the only good serif font that I think is there.
Right.
And numbers 8 through 1 are animation. Animation is what I want. I want transitions. I want the ability to have people be able to see things change over time. And I want interactivity to have that kind of just UI feedback, really. I would like to have that kind of action happen, like when you hover. There's so much that animation can do for you artistically and analytically. It can highlight what it is that you're trying to show. And I understand that my concerns are not the same concerns as a business user, because I'm much more of, I'm using this as an art project for better or for worse.
Yeah.
But these are the things that I think would make it much more competitive with D3, which has such a higher curve, a steeper curve to learn, but it also has a lot more flexibility in these things that are fairly common now in the greater world.
Totally, but it would totally help. I agree just on that last point. And thank you. I thought, oh no, he's going to put Ted in now, but thanks for sticking to three. That was good. You had me going there. But what I love is, like with animation, it's not, sure, some people can dismiss it as gimmicky, but like say you have a scatter chart and you're in a room with all your managers or who like big bosses. Mm-hmm. When you zoom in, they will get so much more context for like, oh, these other elements are going away because we've zoomed in. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you just click a filter, it just snaps, it changes, and then you lose context. Like, have we zoomed in? Have we zoomed out? I don't get it. Whereas if you have that natural motion of like pulling out or pulling in, you see the data points reacting accordingly. That's so powerful, because then you just get this implicit context, and then people don't need to then go, whoa, this changed. What am I looking at? They're like, oh, I know where we're at now. So I think, I agree. Animation would be amazing. Yeah.
That particularly on a map. Is definitely, because you click on a dot in a map, and if it resizes the extent rectangle into like, well, now I see a dot on gray. Where am I? What's happening? Like you zoom in or zoom out, like that makes it a lot more understandable and intuitive. You're right.
Yeah. And I think that's just thinking about it just now. Like, I think that's what Google Maps does. It's kind of, it's so often when you like click a place, it won't just appear or like, you know, wherever you were, it'll go in and you're like, oh, I get it. It's context. So I think animation.
It moves, it decelerates. Like things do in real life.
Yeah.
Like it makes things feel natural.
Yeah, it's natural, it's relatable. So no, it's, animation's totally, if there's a feature request, I'm hitting that button, signing on the Tableau forum. So yeah. okay, great. So look, we've reached the end. That was pretty rapid fire, and I feel we have so much good stuff in here. So thank you for taking a bit more time out of your busy schedule to chat. So, I feel it's been really fun having you here, and there was so much other content which we could all learn from. So I more than happy to have you back. So we'll just figure that out afterwards. And that's great, man. Thank you. Okay, so that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening, and be sure to check out the show notes for everything we've covered today. And if you're new to the podcast, consider subscribing to stay up to date for latest episodes. Also visit datasaurus-rex.com/welcome to see all of the other data visualization content we have to help you out. Until the next time, thank you. And thank you, Mike.
Thank you.